Heroin is back. As if methamphetamines, cocaine, and OxyContin weren't bad enough, cheap, high-quality heroin is now available in parts of the country. The sources include Colombia and Afghanistan, and a new generation of dealers has developed a new market. In a series broadcast this week on NPR's Morning Edition, we've heard about younger, more suburban addicts, kids as young as 13 years old for whom heroin is easier and cheaper to buy than beer, at least at first. Later in the program, we'll hear about an independent study of one of the nation's most popular tourist attractions, which documents poor care and lax administration at the National Zoo. But first, heroin. If you or a friend or a family member has struggled with heroin addiction, we'd like to hear from you. We'd also be interested to hear from cops and doctors and drug counselors who deal with the problem. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Our first guest is Jack Leary, Assistant Chief Probation Officer at the South Boston Courthouse in Massachusetts. He's worked with drug offenders for nearly 24 years and joins us from member station WBUR in Boston. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon.
We're saying young. How young are the kids you're seeing there in South Boston?
Well, I think it's a national figure. It's not just a South Boston figure, but in the 60s and 70s, the average age of first use was 28.7. In the year 2000, across the country, the average age of first use of the opiates is now down to 17.6.
And compare prices for us, if you will, those two eras again.
Well, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, a bag of heroin cost an individual $30 a bag. In the year 2000, it is $4 a bag.
$4 a bag?
That's right. Cheaper than a six-pack. I think it's about the same price as a McDonald's Happy Meal.
This is also, as we've been talking about, no longer an inner-city phenomenon.
That's correct. In the 60s and 70s, it appeared to be an inner-city phenomenon anchored in the minority communities in those inner cities. This appears to be a white, middle-class problem that has circulated throughout the country now. On the East Coast, it appears that it's Colombian heroin, very pure, very potent. I should point out that in the 60s and 70s, a bag of heroin was about 5% pure. In the year 2000, we're running in the 80s, high 80s, and even into the 90s percent pure. So you touch this drug the first time, you're off and running.
Now, obviously, the reports that we've been hearing on Morning Edition, in part because of the reporters we assigned to it, have been based there in Boston. But it's not just Boston. What about other parts of the country?
Well, I have reports from all over the country. We've been to national meetings, and I can tell you Plano, Texas went through an epidemic recently in the last few years. Portland, Maine reports more deaths than we saw in Boston in a 10-month period, and that was last year. Recently, the governors of all New England states met to address this issue, and each governor reported an epidemic within their state.
Now, what are the you mentioned deaths, and obviously that can result from overdoses and a number of other things. Is that the worst problem with heroin?
Well, that's the statistics that's most telling. If you lose a loved one in your family, obviously that is the worst statistic. And I can just tell you that in the year 1999, in the area of South Boston, we suffered approximately 28 fatal overdoses. In the year 2000, 16. In the year 2001, we were down to 10 to 12. In the year 2002, we got to 6. But in 2003, we've had a 100% increase in our mortality rate, directly as a result of a 40%, in my opinion, 40% decline in treatment availability within the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Budget cuts.
Yeah. There's also other health problems involved in heroin use. Once you get to a needle, needles get dirty.
That's correct. And in the United States, anybody that uses heroin for approximately a year is playing Russian roulette with their health. We find that within 1 year nationally, your chances of contracting hepatitis B and C are about 100%. Your chances of contracting HIV are near that figure. Stay with the needle, which you must stay, because this drug compels you to go from snorting heroin to shooting heroin. And in order to maintain your high and not to get sick, you're going to begin to share needles. And unfortunately, as well as you're aware of, Neil, as the age goes down, kids become more and more careless as they're younger. They think they're not going to die.
Mm-hmm.
They're more sexually active. They're more physically active. And that those diseases are being spread all across our nation.
Well, talk also about that progression you were just describing for us. At $4 a bag, this might seem, at least at first, like an affordable habit.
No one who uses the opiates can afford the habit. because the habit requires, as you move to week 2 or week 3 or week 4 of your addiction, you must use more and more of this drug in order not to get sick. So you begin to steal more and more things in order to keep from getting sick. That's called tolerance. This drug requires that you generate more and more use in order not to get sick and to try and get back to that first high that was achieved with that first $4 bag of heroin, which in many cases is being given to people. Because, Neil, if I could give you a product today and maybe tomorrow and maybe the next day, and then I don't have to worry about giving you a product, you're going to come to me and ask me for that product and pay me for that product. This drug requires that type of use.
Mm-hmm. You, as I said, you've been working there for 24 years now. How bad is the problem now? Can you put it on a scale? You were there then during the big crack cocaine epidemic.
I did not see in the community of South Boston, nor in other sections within Boston, certain sections had their crack cocaine problem, the volume of mortality that we're seeing in the last 5 years, and I'll put it in personal terms. My first 19 years of service, I do not recall this much trauma and tragedy as I've seen in the last 5 years of service because of the introduction of pure, cheap cocaine on the streets of Boston.
Let's get some callers involved. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Malcolm, and Malcolm is with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Yes. Hi. I am a 40-year-old heroin addict. I'm currently at work at the moment, so I can't really shout it from where I'm at, but my problem specifically is I've been on a waiting list for methadone treatment here in Columbus since September 19th of the year 2002. And every time I call about once every 2 weeks down to the clinic, there's no light at the end of my tunnel as to when they're going to be able to get me on the program because there's no money in the budget.
We were hearing from Jack Leary about budget cuts in Massachusetts. I assume you're having the same problems in Ohio?
Well, the problem is that currently you have an administration that views methadone just as evilly as it views heroin. And like it or not, methadone is one of the very few solutions for containing the addiction. And I know I personally, when I can obtain methadone illegally, it's a lifesaver because instead of spending $40 a day, I get to spend $60 for 1 week to stay well.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get a response from Jack Leary on that.
Well, Malcolm, you're facing the same problem that I think all of America faces in this war on drugs, and that's that we don't underline the word treatment. And let me show you how important it is to get someone treatment. The average heroin user in the state of Massachusetts, or in my particular area, is using 25 bags a day. Times $4 a bag, that's $100 a day stolen from the community. 7 days a week, $700 times 4 weeks a month, $2,800. When someone gets on methadone, or when someone gets on a new medication called Suboxone, they stop stealing. They work. They pay taxes. They get better. They do not spread hepatitis B and C, and they do not spread HIV. All that benefits the taxpayers, and the crime rate goes down. So, Malcolm, keep trying, because you're a blessing to the taxpayers if you get sober.
Well,
and to yourself.
Yeah, and just the sheer fact that I've been able to keep my job, and which, you know, I'm college educated. It's not like I'm flipping burgers here. As a matter of fact, I'm involved in the healthcare industry, and you know, it's so frustrating seeing the government do next to nothing when the tools are there. It's right in front of you, but instead, you know, instead of solving a problem with $10, they're, you know, watching it go unsolved and thousands are getting spent.
Okay, Malcolm, good luck to you. But I assume your employer does not know about you.
Yeah, and I prefer to keep it that way.
I can understand. Best of luck to you, Malcolm. Hang in there.
Great, cool, thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to another caller, and this is Nancy, and Nancy is with us from Woodside, California.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, my comment is that, well, first of all, my niece, who's graduating from my alma mater this year in Tenimmonson, New Jersey, goes to a high school that was dubbed Heroin High a few years back, a nice white suburban upper middle class school, and I was shocked to learn it was a few years ago there were 5 deaths the summer after these other group of kids had graduated from heroin overdose. And I see a lot of alcohol use amongst the kids that's kind of condoned. And then I think the other problem that why they're using the heroin is that a lot of the misinformation they get through their health and DARE programs is really ineffective in that tell them it's all bad, and then these kids try all this stuff, and they start out maybe with marijuana, and they're like, well, you know, not so bad, and they don't see a distinction. They're not taught a distinction between some of the really addictive drugs, and also they're never really told don't drink alcohol as well, and I think that contributes to a lot. It's just, it was a total party scene, and still is, actually, for my niece, and I don't... Luckily, it's been a few years since there's been any heroin deaths, but it shocked me that my alma mater had this problem.
I assume you've talked to your niece about heroin.
No, but I think it was talked about quite a bit after the deaths that happened at the school. There were five kids that had graduated, and that summer, obviously, it was pretty prevalent. Unfortunately, they still have a huge problem with alcohol. She's been to parties where the police have even come by, and they tell the kids to go home. You know, mm-hmm. It's kind of like, yeah, no big deal. And there's too much. I don't know how to address the issue, but I just see a lot of just kind of partying going on, and then it escalates. And part of it is, I think, the alcohol is condoned, and then they're kind of told, you know. Like I said, maybe it's the misinformation why they would do heroin. I mean, it was never anything that any of us would have thought about when we were growing up. I don't know.
Yeah. So. Jack Leary, does that sound like a familiar story to you?
Sure does. I think what's going on is because we are ineffective on the war on drugs by not underlining treatment, working with enforcement, and a third element of an effective war on drugs is education in our community. In fact, tonight we're having an open forum on hope and recovery hosted by all the private nonprofit agencies and parent groups in the area. And that's to bring families a firsthand education on the danger of substance abuse. And we underline alcohol and marijuana as a gateway drug. It's taught in all the schools in the Boston community now. The mayor of the city of Boston has been championing the cause of putting a substance abuse curriculum into each and every school, both private and parochial, and offering that education so that families realize the danger of playing with substance abuse. It's firsthand from my family. I've lost my oldest brother, who is a decorated war hero. It did not save his life. It took his life. And kids need to be made aware at a young age, that there is help for family members. This disease has a cure, or at least a treatment, but you must stay with that treatment. And if we begin to advertise this disease as a disease within families, then we will get the help for people early on in their career on substance abuse so that the disease does not progress, so it gets treatment at a very early age.
Nancy, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go quickly to Nate, and Nate's with us from Oberlin Park, Kansas.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, well, I'm a guitar teacher, and most of my student base is around the age you're talking, and also stereotypically of that student or of the age you're talking, more fluent, middle class, and some use soft drugs right now, which is culturally acceptable, you know, around here, but with one-on-one time with each student that I have the luxury of having during the day, if I do see some signs, what are some really positive, more effective intervention steps that I can take?
Jack Leary?
Well, I think if you see some serious signs of opiate use, that you need to address the problem head-on. If we're talking about gateway drugs, I would encourage, yes, the one-on-one work, but also a curriculum gets set up because of peer pressure, because you're competing against bad people who like to introduce drugs into a school or into a neighborhood. Sometimes the problem gets very large, and if you try and take it on one-on-one, you isolate yourself against the peer pressure. And therefore, I would suggest a curriculum. One of the most wonderful things I've seen in the South Boston community is we put together a parent group very early on our attack on this particular phenomenon, on death in our community by virtue of heroin. The parents rallied around us because they saw us as helpful. Now they've spun off on their own, and they're running the curriculums.
Nate, thanks very much, and good luck to you. And Jack Leary, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Jack Leary, Assistant Chief Probation Officer at the South Boston Courthouse in Massachusetts. He was with us from WBUR. More after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the rise of heroin addiction among young people in particular. If you have a personal experience, yourself, a friend, a family member, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And joining us now from his office in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, is Robert Waxler. His son, Jonathan, died of a heroin overdose at the age of 26 in 1995. He and his wife have written a book about their son's battle with addiction called Losing Jonathan. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Can you, I know this is difficult to talk about, but tell us, if you would, a little bit about your son and how he became addicted to heroin.
Well, Jonathan died when he was 26 years old. He, up until about a year before his death, from our perspective, he was really just perfectly on track, heading destined for success in terms of the American dream. He had romped through the public school corridors of life. He had been a co-captain of the golf team in high school. He had been on the honor roll. He had gone as an undergraduate to University of Massachusetts in Amherst and done exceptionally, you know, done very well there. And at the end of 4 years, graduated. And then he went on to graduate school. He had a master's degree. He had a wonderful vision of social justice. Came from what I would think of as somewhat privileged family, and he wanted to give back something, and he shared that vision with others. He was working to organize labor and labor unions and things like that. So he looked, in my mind, as if he was doing exactly what one would hope a son would do, and in many ways he was. He had also gone to, obviously, parties as an undergraduate in high school and been exposed to drugs, but there was really little sign from him, at least as I read it, or my wife Linda read it, that he was in serious trouble in terms of drugs, until one day, about a year before his tragic overdose, he got a call. It was a Sunday morning, from one of his friend's mothers, who I didn't really know at the time very well, but she said that she felt compelled to call because she really felt that Jonathan might be in trouble. And then in that conversation, she said, "I think he might be taking heroin." And that word, for me, is kind of innocent to so much of this. I'm well-sheltered, mm-hmm. middle-class life, I suppose, really shook me to the bone. It was something I couldn't believe. And I remember getting off the phone that Sunday morning and telling my wife Linda about it, and she yelled out, "No, never! This person must have the wrong number. It couldn't be happening."
Yeah, heroin's like the atomic bomb or cancer. I mean, it's
It was like it was an explosion.
Yeah. So what did you do?
Well, I immediately got in touch with Jonathan. We had a wonderful, tightly knit family. We always talked to each other, and I told him I had gotten this call and explained to him, obviously, our concerns. And he happened to be going to he was working in New York at the time, and he was going to go pick some things up and about 2 hours away, but in Massachusetts. So I said, "Well, I think we'll meet you there and we'll talk more about it." So we drove that day. I remember it was a very hot day in the summer, my wife and I, to meet him, and hoping that what we had heard was incorrect, believing in a sense that it must be some kind of dream. And we talked with him that day, and he finally admitted that he had been taking heroin, but he wasn't taking it currently any longer.
And was he right, or as...
He was already involved in this kind of incredible process of deception. We found out a few weeks later, in another incident where I drove up to New York to meet him, he was, in fact, still taking heroin.
And I assume you got him at various points involved in rehabilitation programs. And
yeah, once I heard that, the next year literally became a battle of life and death, taking him from one detox center to another, from one halfway house to another across the country. He was in several, and it was a battle that we were all joined in as a family. I had a younger brother, and we all obviously wanted to do everything possible to keep him alive, and he wanted to be alive. No one wakes up one day and says, "I want to be a heroin addict."
Yeah.
But the drug had him.
Did he ever tell you why he started taking it in the first place?
Well, he said at one point that he, you know, he tried it. He was the kind of guy who always wanted to explore all the imaginative possibilities of life. He was extraordinarily bright, and He was out continually exposed to these drug buffets, I'm sure, on various occasions. And I think this was one of his many explorations into unknown territory. But he once said during that last year that he only had to take it once, and he was hooked. And after that, it was the battle of a lifetime. And I think in part what he was talking about, again, was the power of this particular drug, heroin, the cravings that people inevitably get. And he was wired. I think some people are clearly more wired for this, more susceptible to the drug than others. He was certainly wired for this kind of craving.
We're going to be talking more about the power of this particular drug in just a minute. But I did want to ask you, Robert Waxler, what was the effect of your son's death on the rest of your family, including his brother?
Well, it was it certainly had a profound effect. We wrote this book, Losing Jonathan, in part to demonstrate the fragile nature of all these things of human life and how much this kind of addiction, like, and death itself, of course, is always a family matter. It's always a family affair. We think sometimes about the stereotype about heroin addicts as people in back alleys, isolated, poverty-stricken by themselves. But in fact, this is a story about a family and the disruption and ultimate reversal of all sorts of emotions and feelings. His younger brother loved him very much. He looked up to him as Jonathan was the older brother, somebody who gave him guidance and gave him some kind of direction. And Jeremy at the time was at Tufts University when Jonathan died, and that clearly had a profound effect on him, and it had a profound effect on Linda, his mother, my wife, and me. And it really started at the day of that phone call. It's as if there are two phases to this. The last year of his life, where he's really almost the ghost of his old self, he's battling with heroin, it's not really the same person any longer. It's as if in that morning it was clear and sunny until we got the phone call, and then everything becomes cloudy and misty, and we're in a different world. And then the second phone call from the doctor in California, where he was at the time, telling the coroner, telling us that he had died. So there's a more permanent loss there, and it obviously changes everyone's life. And the loss is so, I think, parental grief, loss of a child or a parent is, I think, the greatest tragedy of all, because there's something unnatural about that. Generations are confused. The children are your future. All that was at stake, and all that was certainly part of the battle, and all that had a profound effect on the entire family, the fathers, mothers, I'm sure everywhere, brothers and sisters as well. It's something we never completely recover from. Can't.
No, of course not.
That's the power, in part, the power of this drug, the power of heroin. No one, including Jonathan, who was, in so many ways, a man of extraordinary intelligence, destined, I think, for greatness. No one wanted to see him die. He didn't want to see himself die, obviously. He realized what he was doing to the family that last year, too. And he did what he can to, as I say, to engage in this battle, try to beat this drug, which he just couldn't beat.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Jessica, and Jessica's on the line with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. I'm working with someone right now who will go to the bathroom for about 10 minutes when we're closing, and he'll come back, and his eyes will be red, and he'll be sweating, and he keeps asking me if it's hot. And I suspect heroin use, but I'm not really familiar with the signs.
Robert Waxler, any advice?
Well, again, heroin grabs you, and it certainly, people fall in love with the drug, and they develop these incredible strategies of deception.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're describing is certainly possibly signs of heroin addiction, but what is, to me, even more surprising, and certainly was to large numbers of people who knew Jonathan, that the deceptions and the strategies can be so incredible that you don't know for a long time sometimes whether somebody's taking it or not. And people are so obsessed by the drug that they, you know, it's a full-time job for them to keep this cover story, to continue to employ these various deceptions. People, Jonathan, when I met him in New York, you know, he was working for organizing with the unions. He looked as if he was doing fine. And we took him that day. We took him over to a psychologist who was an expert in drugs to find out if there was anything going on there before he admitted it. And the psychologist looked at him and said, "You know, I don't think he's taking drugs." This guy was an expert. He knew a lot about heroin, and he couldn't recognize it. So that too is part of the issue here. People want, on the one hand, they want to get off it after a while, but on the other hand, they are so drawn to it that they're in this kind of battle of wanting not to do it and at the same time being seduced and drawn into it.
Jessica, I'm certainly no expert, but it does sound like something may be going on, and you certainly may want to have a conversation with your friend, especially if the person is important to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you.
And good luck to you.
Bye.
Then Robert Waxler, we wanted to thank you for your time today and for sharing your story. I know it can't be easy to talk about.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Robert Waxler's book about his son's battle with addiction is called Losing Jonathan. He spoke to us from his office in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We want to turn now to talk about why heroin addiction is so difficult to kick and what new treatments may be available. Joining us is Dr. Judith Martin, a family physician certified in addiction medicine. She's also medical director of two treatment centers in Oakland, California, the 14th Street Clinic and the East Bay Recovery Project. And Dr. Martin joins us from the studios of radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello, Neil. Good afternoon.
Why is it that heroin is so addictive? That story that Robert Waxler was telling about his son getting hooked the first time, that's not all that unusual.
Yes. Addictive substances are often very rapidly acting. In other words, they hit your brain really fast, and then they wear off really fast. And so it requires taking it over and over and over to achieve the same effects. And in the process of doing that, your body gets really efficient in processing the drug, and then tolerance develops, is what Jack was saying earlier, mm-hmm. where you need more and more and more of the substance. And initially, it's taken for pleasure the first few times. It affects the pleasure parts of the brain. But after repeated ingestion of the drug, it recruits other parts of the brain that have more to do with day-to-day survival. So, and the brain becomes sensitized to the lack of the drug, so that when you don't have the drug, your brain is saying, this is a survival issue, we have to get more of this, of the drug. So,
now, yes.
Yes, exactly. And at the same time, with heroin, there are a number of physical withdrawal symptoms that are very obvious when the person hasn't ingested heroin if they're addicted. In 4 to 6 hours, they start to have very uncomfortable physical symptoms, including things like runny nose, tearing eyes, their blood pressure goes up, their pulse pounds, they might be nauseated, vomiting, and it becomes unbearable mentally and physically not to have the drug. So that's addiction. At that point, we say the person is physically dependent on the medication.
We're speaking with Dr. Judith Martin. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And is heroin addiction, how is it different from cocaine or OxyContin or amphetamines?
It's not very different from OxyContin, because OxyContin is also a short-acting opiate, the way that it's abused anyway, where the tablet is broken so that the impact is immediate in the brain and it wears off in a short time when it's misused. So OxyContin is in the same family as heroin and other opiates. So it's not very different from OxyContin. It is different from cocaine, not in its addictive ability. Cocaine can be very extremely addictive. The symptoms of withdrawal are somewhat physically milder with cocaine, but the craving in the case of cocaine is very severe as well, and people do become very much addicted to cocaine and stimulants. Amphetamines also acts in a similar way to cocaine in the brain in the sense that it stimulates the system, but in the case of amphetamines, it actually damages the neurons, so amphetamines have that in addition to worry about. So all of these substances are very addictive and very dangerous. Fortunately, with heroin addiction, we do have some pretty good medical treatments for people who are addicted.
Well, let's get a caller on the line, and Jeremy is with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing?
Okay.
I'm calling today. I was just listening earlier, and I myself, I'm a recovering drug addict and alcoholic. I'm 20 years old. I've been sober nearly 2 years now. And, you know, I'd just like to say that this is a disease. It's a horrible disease. It's a spiritual disease, an emotional disease, a physical disease. It totally bankrupts you. There is no cure for this. The only thing that I do, that I can do continually on a daily basis is I go to support groups. I volunteer, I help out with adolescents and other people that were in the same shoes that I was in at one time, and I continue to live a life of helping others.
Well, that Jeremy, first of all, hang in there. Dr. Martin, that's a positive outcome as far as this is concerned, isn't it?
Yeah, Jeremy brings up a very interesting thing about the field of addiction treatment in that it's a very holistic field. It includes peer support, such as 12-step programs, for example, the recovery model of treatment. It includes working to change your behavior, changing bad habits by training yourself to act in different ways. It includes working on emotional pain. Some people say they'll use a drug to numb emotional pain, and so that means that maybe therapy or counseling or peer support would help them with that issue. And it includes an approach to spiritual work in the sense that some people use, it's a miserably failed use of the drug to transcend ordinary life, to step beyond the humdrum existence, and instead they end up enslaved in something that's like slave labor the rest of their lives trying to get the drug. So people to reach beyond themselves, to service is often a very big part of people's recovery. And we also have some medical treatments for heroin addiction that that your caller Malcolm mentioned earlier, methadone maintenance. It has a very good track record, 40 years now of saving lives, and also the newer treatment of buprenorphine.
We're going to be talking about those in more detail when we come back from a break. Jeremy, thanks very much for the phone call.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. We're going to continue our discussion, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about why heroin is so powerfully addictive and what treatment is available to help people kick the habit. This after a series of reports this week on NPR's Morning Edition talking about the availability of cheap and very pure heroin in many parts of the country. If you want to find out more about those stories from NPR's week-long series, you can go to our website, npr.org, click on the Talk of the Nation page. Our guest is Dr. Judith Martin, a family physician certified in addiction medicine. She runs two treatment centers in Oakland, California. And Dr. Martin, just before the break, you were mentioning medical treatments for addiction, including a drug I'm unfamiliar with, buprenorphine. Tell us more about that.
Yes. Well, as you know, methadone maintenance has been around for a long time, which is using another substance that attaches to the same receptor site. It's an opiate. It maintains the physical dependence, but it normalizes brain function and body function because the patient's not high and not in withdrawal either. So the person and the body can readjust and start to act normally as long as you maintain a steady dose of the medication, so that it acts as a platform for a patient to carry out their recovery work. And recently, in the fall of 2002, the FDA approved a new formulation of a medication called buprenorphine that also is able to do this maintenance treatment. In other words, you can use sublingual buprenorphine. The brand name of it is Suboxone. to do maintenance treatment, and it's available with some restrictions in any doctor's offices. So you don't have to go to a special licensed facility, a methadone clinic, and methadone is extremely regulated, so you don't have to stand in line and comply with a whole set of rules that might not really apply to you, that's not individualized to your care.
When you say it's sublingual, in other words, it's something you put under your tongue, you're not injecting anything.
That's right. It's a tablet that you put under your tongue. It dissolves slowly. It's not like nitroglycerin that disappears instantly. It dissolves slowly over about 8 to 10 minutes. And during that time, the patient can't talk, can't swallow, has to hold all the juice in their mouth, so because the medication goes in through the mucous membranes into the bloodstream. And it's quite long-acting. It lasts a day or sometimes 2 days in the body. It attaches to the same receptors that heroin attaches to, and it takes up that space. In other words, the affinity to the receptor is very high, so that if someone uses another opiate, it won't have an effect. So patients will say, yes, I tried to use, but I didn't feel it, because it has a blocking effect on the receptor.
Now, are you using this yourself, and is it working?
Yes, I'm using it with several patients, and it's being used all over the country right now, and it's working very well. There have been a number of clinical trials as well, research, you know, in the United States that has shown that it works really well. It's been used in France for, I guess, almost 10 years now.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Mike is with us from Portland, Maine.
Yeah, where Susan Chisholm did a report on the opiate addictions up in Washington County this morning on Morning Edition.
Absolutely.
I'm calling. I had a couple of questions, one about methadone maintenance and one about the disease concept in general. But I don't understand how we call methadone a treatment program, because really what we're doing, or even the new drug that your guest just talked about, what we're doing is we're taking one addiction, one drug, and substituting another drug, and we're having all these addicts addicted to a second drug that just happens to be more controlled and maybe a little bit safer. There are several methadone clinics up here in Portland. There have been a lot of news stories in the past year, over 6 or 7 deaths on methadone this year. That's become a major story and a major problem up here. And frankly, I don't understand that either, because if the people were on heroin, there would have been far more deaths. But how is that called a treatment? It's just substituting an addiction, just like in Annie Hall in the Woody Allen movie, when he looks back at his classmates and somebody says, I used to be a heroin addict, now I'm a methadone addict.
Dr. Martin?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. It's a really common conception about methadone maintenance that's not quite true. The only thing that's the same is that the medication is an opiate, and if you stop it, you would go into withdrawal. In other words, it is it attaches to the same receptor sites. It's in the same family as heroin and oxycodone and OxyContin and all those other opiate drugs. But the big difference is that it's has a slow onset. Remember I said that things that are very addictive have a rapid onset and short action. This has a slow onset, very long action, so that you can find a stabilizing dose that allows the brain to function normally. And this is shown by the patient's behavior. It's also shown now that we have PET scans. We can show that the brain actually does look like a normal brain when somebody's on methadone maintenance. So you could say, well, sometimes people compare it to somebody being on insulin. It's not a cure, but it's a treatment that controls the disease. We never call it a cure. This is and as you said, the disease model is one that's being used a lot because it helps patients think about addiction. And think about teenagers who are being told they're addicted and they have to adjust to this concept that they have something that they're going to have to be dealing with the rest of their lives. That's a big adjustment, just
well,
as if you told it.
Teenagers, that I work with teenage addicts, and this whole addiction model in some ways doesn't really work, because it's not letting people know that they have a choice as to whether they're going to go on or not. All of a sudden, the addict is being told, I have a disease, I have no control, it hit me, and I'm not effective in doing anything about it because it's a disease that I have. It's not my responsibility any longer. I'm not responsible for what I do. It's a disease that's responsible.
Yeah.
Well, people with diseases, chronic illnesses, are definitely responsible for their illnesses. And as somebody who's worked in family practice for years, almost every chronic disease, meaning that we don't have a cure for it, right, that makes it chronic, but we have treatments, requires a lot of concentration and behavior changes and adjustments. You might have to lose weight. You might have to change your diet. You might have to exercise. There are a lot of very concentrated efforts that the patient has to make, and this is no different. Someone who's on methadone maintenance has to have counseling and testing and is encouraged to go to groups. And the people who do well on those treatments are invisible. They come in and they take home a month's worth of medications just as if they were going to a doctor's office for anything else, and they're working next to you. The ones who aren't doing so well need higher level of care, need more treatment, and are more visible. Because they're getting trouble.
Mike, I wanted to get one more call in, so I wanted to thank you for the call, but wanted to move on, if you don't mind.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much. Let's go now to, let's go to John, and John's with us from Jamestown, New York.
Hey, how's it going, Neil?
All right.
First of all, I just want to say I love your show, and I really respect the fact that you're doing this as a topic, because I think this is a really important topic.
Thanks.
Today's society, I personally have a large number of friends, unfortunately, who have all overdosed and died within the last 5 years of my life from heroin. And I don't know, I just wanted to call in and basically just, like I said, pay you my respects because I really appreciate that you're doing this.
Okay.
And one of the things I wanted to say is that it kind of bothers me, to be honest with you, that people label things like marijuana as, say, like a gateway drug. Because out of all of my friends, out of the hundreds of people I know, because I toured around the country, I'm not going to say with what band, but I've toured around the country for years with various musical bands and met many friends through that. And like your other guests were saying, the scary thing about it is you really don't know. Like, it can be your closest friend, it could be your brother, your sister, your mother, your father, and you could not know at all.
John, marijuana is another subject for another show, okay?
Oh yeah, that wasn't the gist of my topic.
Okay, all right. Appreciate the phone call and thanks for the kind words.
Yep.
And sorry to hear about your friends. Dr. Martin, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Judith Martin is medical director of the 14th Street Clinic and the East Bay Recovery Project, both in Oakland, California. She joined us from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. Before we leave the subject, an email we got from CJ in Central New York. As a grown child of an IV heroin addict who died about 10 years ago of AIDS, as a child I was often taken to his spot in some of the most dangerous neighborhoods of New York City, where I had no choice but to watch him stab himself repeatedly with needles. He consoled his conscience by stating that he was showing me what not to do. Luckily, I took the lesson, along with a broken home, prison visitations, and his death at 41 years of age. Hopefully, reading this on the air might make some impact on any young adults considering trying this disgusting perversion of partying. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.